Chapter 24. This was truly hilarious. A mess room full of strapping macho blokes, all spraying expensive men's cologne on their wrists and discussing it with utter seriousness. Priceless. Robbie wished he had the courage to video it on his smartphone. Once the room was reeking of terrible Teddy, Robbie took the precious bottle and walked through to control, where he treated all the officers there to a whiff. It took around half an hour to seek out most of the men and women who were likely to be out on the streets and have a chance of crossing Ashcroft's path. He even sprayed a little onto a handkerchief and allowed the dog handler to offer it to his canine partner. The German Shepherd merely coughed, unimpressed. He returned to the CID room, sat down at his desk, and stared at the distinctive bottle. Smaller things than this had led to the capture of criminals in the past. One thing was for sure. When this case was finally over, he never wanted to smell that perfume again. Charlie Button called out to him from the other side of the office.
"Boss wants us in his office, mate. He said to bring a chair and your notebook."
Robbie picked up his notepad and took his chair to Jackman's office. Marie and Gary were already there, and Charlie and Rosie were gathering up chairs. What was this all about? As soon as everyone was seated, Jackman began. "Ruth, Crook, and I agree that there is little point in us wasting time trying to track the sniper. We already have highly trained uniformed officers out there asking questions and following up leads so they can carry on. We are going to do what we set out to do in the first place, hunt for Alistair Ashcroft." He picked up a sheet of paper. "To this end, I have had Rosie trawl through the last investigation and pull out any addresses or locations that he was connected to, even slightly, and list them. We'll work in pairs and visit each place, then widen the search to anywhere else that might be connected or in some way attractive to him. We'll go armed with a new set of photos that Orac has produced in IT. She has aged him slightly and made subtle changes in each picture, in the hopes that even if he's disguised, one of them may bear some resemblance to his real self. We'll talk to anyone who will listen and show them the pictures." Robbie was relieved that they were going to be doing something concrete, even if it did remind him of being back in uniform and doing house-to-house inquiries. Robbie was determined to be the one to find Ashcroft. The man had made a fool of him, and Robbie Melton couldn't be doing with that. "To start with, we'll tackle the estate agent who handled the properties Ashcroft got rid of around a year ago. He may have been back since, either buying or selling or renting, of course. If that fails, as I suspect it will, we'll try all the other estate agents and letting companies in Salton and the surrounding area. He has to have a base. You take that, Gary and Rosie." He stared at the list again. "Robbie and Charlie, I want you to check out his old solicitor, paying particular attention to the properties that were in his possession, just in case he didn't sell them all before he disappeared. There was also a woman who had business dealings with him pertaining to the sale of his properties. Her name was Philippa or Pip Courtney. Ashcroft deceived her badly, and I doubt that she now harbours the fond feelings that she had for him then, but she saw a lot of him. She would recognise him if she saw him, I'm certain of that."
"And me, boss?" asked Marie.
"We are going to church."
"To confess our sins?"
Marie grinned at him. "Could do that as well if you like, but no. To see if Ashcroft has made an appearance in any of them. If you remember, last time he used a lot of biblical quotes and references, and we deduced that he liked to frequent churches. He was also known to attend meetings and volunteer for charity work, all church-based. Maybe he's trying something like that now." "It's a good cover, hiding under the petticoats of religious do-gooders. He's got such a silver tongue, he'd have them all eating out of his hand in no time," Marie scowled.
"Exactly," Robbie said somewhat bitterly. "You only have to think how he deceived the Lorimer family, and us, to know how damn good he is.
And let's not forget that missing motorbike, the one he got away from Hawker's Fen on. Did he ditch it, store it somewhere, give it away, or sell it? Eyes and ears open, guys," Jackman said.
They were just about to leave when Jackman stopped them. He looked at Rosie, smiled, and said, There is one other thing that you should know. Listening, Robbie wasn't surprised to hear that Rosie was leaving. He'd been amazed at how she and Max had coped thus far. It was a sensible decision, but he would miss her a lot. He'd always admired her dogged tenacity. Like a terrier, she'd never let anything go. They all crowded around, wishing her well. There were hugs, tears were shed. Then Jackman told them that they would have a proper send-off later, but right now they were too busy chasing a certain psychopath. Robbie looked across to Charlie. Ready? Charlie nodded.
Ready.
And I want you wearing Kevlar vests whenever you are out on the streets, Jackman added. Ruth has arranged for CID officers as well as uniformed officers to have these for the duration of this situation. They are stab and ballistic resistant, but only to handgun standard. They won't stop a sniper's bullet, I'm afraid. But we know our assassin uses a handgun too, so it's worth wearing one, okay?
Oh, hell, I hate those things,
Marie muttered. Think yourself lucky you aren't having to wear the heavier kit, you know? The one the armed response units and the firearms officers have to use. And no excuses, Marie Evans. You, of all people, should protect yourself as much as possible. After all, you and I are at the top of his list, aren't we? Pulling a face, Marie reluctantly agreed. We've only got an hour and a half before the 4 o'clock meeting, so do what you can this afternoon and crack straight on in the morning, okay? They all nodded, gathered up their chairs and left the office. Back in the CID room, Robbie took Rosie aside.
You don't have to go out this afternoon, you know. Jackman will understand. These are your last few hours here. Do you want to spend them traipsing around estate agents knowing there's a sniper on the loose? You could make a whole lot of inquiries by phone.
She smiled at him.
Thanks for caring, Robbie. But until I hand over my warrant card, I'm a police officer. And why the hell would I want to stay here on my own while you lot are having fun hunting killers?
He threw up his hands.
I give in. Just be careful, okay?
He'd done his best to dissuade her, feeling he owed it to Max, but Rosie was clearly having none of it.
Let's go and grab one of those new vests then, shall we? He said.
Gary could not believe the change that had come over the town. Sultan Lefen was no metropolis, being smaller even than Greenborough, but it was a bustling market town, whose twice-weekly farmers' market attracted locals and visitors alike. Now it was practically deserted, and the few shoppers who were out hurried along the streets, heads down, keeping close to the shop fronts.
This is weird, whispered Rosie.
Ruth Crook's warning has hit home, I'd say.
Gary looked around.
There are more police on the streets than civilians.
Can't blame them, I must say.
She checked her list for the address of the first estate agent.
No one knows where or when the gunman will strike again.
Not sure he'd agree with you.
Gary indicated to a man, clearly drunk, staggering around the deserted market square, shouting,
You want me? Come and fucking get me, asshole. Hiding in the fucking shadows, bloody coward.
Before Gary even had a chance to move, two uniformed officers materialized from nowhere and escorted him away.
He's got a point, muttered Rosie. It is a cowardly thing to do, shoot someone.
They walked on.
That's something that bothers me about all this. Think back to the horrific scenarios, the slow, terrible deaths that Ashcroft's evil mind concocted for his original victims. Why has he changed his M.O. so radically this time around and hired a shooter?
Gary thought about this.
Maybe it's because last time he was enacting just retribution as he saw it. Now it's a vendetta against the police. Well, the boss and the Sarge, to be exact. So execution-style deaths are more appropriate, and for that you need an expert.
I just find it hard to equate such an impersonal method with Alistair Ashcroft.
Gary shrugged.
Well, we know he likes guns. After all, he did shoot Jackman and tried to shoot Marie, didn't he?
True. And maybe he likes the power of sending out a minion to kill in his name.
Rosie stopped and double-checked the list.
Milgate and Forshaw. Let's talk to them.
It didn't take long
to realize that they were wasting their time. The manager was more concerned that the spate of murders would bring house prices down and affect his business.
Cancellations. That's all I've had. No one wants to go viewing houses in a town that's being terrorized. In 2 years, Salton will be a ghost town, you mark my words.
Rosie had showed him the photographs of Ashcroft in his many possible guises, but Milgate just shook his head.
I've had no one that looks even vaguely like that in here.
He passed the pictures to two rather miserable-looking young men who agreed that they hadn't seen him either. They gave up. Outside, Gary said,
I've a feeling this is a taste of things to come. Who's next?
The new one down Galleon Alley. Galleon Homes? They're relatively new, and as far as I can remember, they mainly do long-term lets. Rosie led the way down a narrow, cobbled lane with shops on either side. At least this time they were greeted with an expectant smile, a definite improvement on Milgate. Introducing himself and Rosie, Gary learned that the agent was called Ronnie Beasley, and he was pretty much a one-man band. With just one assistant, who was out doing a valuation, he handled most of the transactions personally.
"Can't be too negative about this situation, can we?" said Beasley. "Things have a habit of flaring up and then dying down and becoming yesterday's news. People will always want houses or places to rent."
Gary commended his positive attitude.
"Any chance this man has been in here, sir, possibly wanting to rent somewhere?"
Beasley stared at the pictures, before pausing at one of Orak's computer-generated likenesses.
"There's something about this one that rings bells."
Gary held his breath. He felt Rosie tense beside him.
"He may not look exactly like that. These are just approximations," said Gary hopefully. "Do you think you've seen him?"
Beasley frowned.
"Yes, about 6 weeks, 2 months ago. A man who looked something like this came in looking for a property to rent. I remember he was very particular about his requirements and money didn't seem to be a concern. Sadly, I didn't have anything that suited him."
"Sir," Rosie leaned forward, "how did he differ from this picture? Could you describe him for us?"
"He had very short hair. I think they call it a fade. Fuller on top, then fades to a close cut back and sides. It was a sandy blonde colour. I thought then that it was really a cut for a younger man, but still it suited him."
He gave them a slightly apologetic smile.
"I notice these kind of things because my wife's a men's hairdresser." "Height and age, at a guess?"
asked Gary.
"About my height, but age, I'm not good with ages."
Beasley paused.
"Possibly in his 40s. Casually dressed, but he had that look of money about him, if you know what I mean."
Rosie took a handkerchief from her pocket.
"This is a long shot, sir. I don't suppose you remember if he was wearing a fragrance that smelt like this."
Beasley looked apologetic.
"There I can't help you, officers. I have no sense of smell."
Gary swore under his breath.
"Just our luck.
We get a possible ID, a guy who was up close and personal with our mark, but he can't smell anything."
"If it helps, he looked the kind of man to wear something classy, even if it was just to go to the golf club for drinks."
"Or the gun club."
"Would you have his name on record, sir?"
Gary said,
"and a contact number." "I'll look for you. But when we had exhausted all the houses I had on my books, he told me not to worry. He'd have to look elsewhere. He did say he'd call in again at a later date, should he be unlucky and need to rethink his criteria."
Beasley went to a filing cabinet and thumbed through a series of folders.
Well, I made a note of his name and what he required, but there's no number, I'm afraid."
He returned to the desk and handed Gary a sheet of paper.
"Richard Reeves," Gary murmured.
"Right." He skimmed through the list.
"He was very specific, wasn't he, sir? Detached property, double garage, 3 bedrooms, quiet location, with no near neighbours, and within a 5-mile radius of the town centre." "That's right, officers. He said he would be alone here for a while, then his family would be joining him a little later. He said they had dogs, and he didn't want close neighbours in case the animals disturbed anyone."
Beasley frowned.
Can I see those pictures again, please?
Rosie handed them to him.
Yes, that's definitely him. It's just the hair that's different. The thing that gives him away are the eyes.
He thumbed through the other pictures.
It's the same with all of these photos. You can change everything about that face to make it look different, but apart from changing the iris colour, you can't alter those eyes. They are oddly almond-shaped. I thought it was unusual at the time.
Gary stared at them. Beasley was right. Then he recalled a snippet of information about Alistair Ashcroft from the original case. The special school that he had attended had suspected him of suffering from a genetic disorder called Fragile X syndrome, something that often shows itself in a long, narrow face with large ears and almond-shaped eyes. Alistair had not exhibited all those physical differences, but his eyes were large and almond-shaped. He shivered. Ashcroft had been right here, looking for a new lair.
"Can we take this list, sir? You can rest assured he won't be back."
"Please do.
And I must say, I'm afraid to ask why you want to find him."
Beasley looked at them anxiously. Rosie flashed him a reassuring smile.
"We just need to talk to him about an ongoing investigation, sir, that's all."
But Beasley wasn't to be reassured so easily.
"Has he got something to do with this gunman?"
Gary intervened.
"Please don't worry about it, sir. We just think he might be able to help with another case we're working on. Tell me, what was your impression of him?"
"Bit of a toff. Well off, well spoken, obviously well educated. Had a sense of humour, as I recall, but was rather intense and very picky about what sort of property he was looking for."
Gary nodded.
"Well, thank you for your time, sir. You've been most helpful."
He handed him a card.
"And should you see him again, please ring us immediately."
Beasley nodded.
"I hope you find him, officers."
As they left, Gary saw him quickly flip the sign of the door to closed. Beasley wasn't taking any chances.
"Now we know the kind of property he was looking for, we can see if any of the other agents had a similar request," Rosie said.
For a moment she looked excited, then her face fell.
"Well, you can. We'll never get around all of them before the shift ends or they close, and then, well, it's all over for me."
"And I'm very glad it is, Rosie. Time for you to be a mum and not miss those precious early years, and don't worry about us. We'll catch the bugger for you."
"You better."
She took a slow breath.
"And look out for my Max, won't you, Gary? Until this is over, I'll worry myself sick every time he goes out of the door."
"Of course I will."
Gary was serious now.
"We all will. This team is special. We look out for each other, you know that."
Rosie looked as if she was about to cry again. Then she sniffed and said,
"Okay, Gazza,
let's check that big letting agent just off the market square. With what Beasley told us, we have a better chance now."
"Lead on."